Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Pfizer says its antiviral COVID drug, Paxlovid, stayed 89% effective at reducing the risk of hospitalization and death in a key study of high-risk adults. 89% effective in reducing the risk of hospitalization and death, the antiviral drug, a therapeutic. Oh, we're back to talking about therapeutics.
There we go.
From Pfizer. So can we call Omicron and this whole thing off already? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
That's funny, Dan. What is the name of this antiviral? How do you pronounce it?
Paxlovid.
Paxlovid? Common spelling, right? Okay. Well, that's going to save the world. I mean, Dr. Wardy said yesterday, once Paxlovid, it's approved by the end of the month, this is going to be a game changer. So maybe this is the Democrats' way of getting out of the hole that they've dug themselves in to try and, you know, move forward. Because I don't know if COVID's going to work for them in 2022.
Well, Paxlovid, if you have a therapeutic that's 90% effective, that's actually endorsed by the medical, public health, political establishment, then what are we talking about anymore when it comes to infection? So what? So you got an infection.
Yeah, go rub some dirt on it and get over it and take this Paxlovid.
Right. So then we follow Amtrak's lead and we roll back the vaccine mandates on employees and we're done with firing people over vaccines and we're going to respect bodily autonomy again. Is this really the miracle drug, not necessarily for treatment of COVID because there's many other therapeutics out there now, but again, they haven't been embraced. Even monoclonal antibodies haven't really been embraced by the public health establishment. You never hear them speaking about it. This is from Pfizer. This is for the Pfizer generation, included, that's become the Pfizer generation. I'm talking about kids in school, K through 12. So, right, we're done then. If you say this is effective and the FDA provides its imprimatur, which it will because this is Pfizer, then what do we have left to talk about?
I will say Pekalovic sounds like a Serbian basketball player, doesn't it?
What's Pekalovic?
Or Peklovic. Sorry, the name of this antiviral.
What's Peklovic? I think those are basketball players. I'm talking about Pfizer's drug Paxlovid.
Paxlovid, okay.
Yeah. Pax, P-A-X,
okay,
Lovid,
Pax.
L-O-V-I-D.
Lovid. I got it. Paxlovid. Thank you.
Let's get hooked on phonics.
Let's do it.
Joe Biden, though, still, as of yesterday, rather than touting this study out of Pfizer and this potential breakthrough, still talking about getting vaxxed because, hey, you know, what's
Come
the big
on,
deal?
Man.
And so everybody talks about freedom and not to have a shot or have a test. Well, guess what? And so how about patriotism? How about making sure that you're vaccinated so you do not spread the disease to anybody else? What about that? What's the big deal?
Does he know that 80% of the Omicron cases are from people who are vaccinated? Does he know that if you are vaccinated, you could still spread COVID?
What's the big deal? The UK, by the way, in terms of all this Omicron hysteria, which persists just incredibly, it persists. Yeah. The number of UK Omicron hospitalized revised down from 250 to 10.
Are you kidding me?
No. The deputy prime minister there said they had misspoken about the number.
Okay.
Off by a factor of 25. Misspeaking. That's what the government does. Jason in Northlake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. Morning, guys. How you guys doing?
Morning.
You guys, real quick, yesterday when you guys were talking about masking the kids, Adam Carolla actually pointed this out quite accurately, that it's like crate training a puppy, that as adults, you try to get the adults to wear the mask, and the adults look at you like you're crazy because they have common sense. But when you crate train a puppy, or when you tell the kids very young that the mask will save your lives, you train them young, and that's what it's all about. It's not about protecting the children. It's about indoctrinating the children, just like everything else that the school systems do. And then as far as, like, with the therapeutics and stuff, you know, this is even if COVID went away today, they'll always tell you to mask up because it's like we've said before, well, what about the next disease for tomorrow?
Thanks for the call, Jason. Jim in LaGrange.
Dee and Amy, good morning. So I'll pull, I think the administration is going to keep this going until they decide it's over. So, you know, just pulling an Animal House reference here. Over, did you say over? Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?
It was not. That's correct. All right, Jim. Thanks for the call. Sean in Warrenville.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to say I recently read that The Real Anthony Fauci by Robert Kennedy Jr. And I got to say he calls Pfizer, Moderna, some of these corporations, they're so entwined with the FDA, NIH, NIAID, that they've actually captured those agencies. That's all.
Thanks for the call, Sean. I mean, I'm not a huge RFK Jr. fan. He's an environmental wacko. He is an anti-vaxxer. I am not. However, the agency capture issue is an important one, and that happens in government generally. This is straight public choice theory of economics, that the agencies get captured by those they regulate. And the idea that that is part of what's happened to the FDA and CDC, even though they don't have technical regulatory responsibilities, but the collaboration of these agencies with these big drug companies, that there is blurriness in terms of where the lines and responsibilities are. I completely believe that to be the case. Ron in Salem, Wisconsin.
The main difference that I see between the other therapeutics, like monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, hydrochloroquine, which I've had two of those, the main difference is Pfizer. Did you see the price tag on this new drug? They'll embrace that because Pfizer invented it.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Something else, too, just about Omicron. I mean, here again, since we've stopped talking about Delta and we're just talking about Omicron, and there was this hysteria that is foundationless to this point. Right. You still have the woman in South Africa who identified Omicron virus, Dr. Angelique Coetzee. She's still trying to, like, get people to
calm down.
Just be rational. Yeah.
Right. I mean, why? Again, why do we still have that travel ban in place? Because we know it's not deadly or create more hospitalizations. Driving hospitalizations is the Delta variant in the United States.
Yeah. She says again, writing in the Daily Mail, we clinicians deal day to day with real people, not statistical projections. I can reassure you, the symptoms presenting in those with Omicron are very, very mild compared with those we see with the far more dangerous Delta variant. In South Africa, where I work, there haven't been many patients admitted to hospitals with Omicron. Most have been treated at home using anti-inflammatories such as ibuprofen and low doses of cortisone.
Oh.
Bear in mind, too, most of those who contract Omicron here are unvaccinated. Only 26% of South Africans are fully vaccinated. Well, this is certainly not an argument against vaccination. It's reassuring to know that even unprotected bodies fight off this variant much more easily than Delta. Current data indicates that the majority of cases admitted to ICUs are unvaccinated people. But again, just in terms of providing some context, and this also is what we understand even as laymen about immunology. This is like the basics of immunology. It is normally the case that as a virus mutates, it gets weaker in terms of its lethality. So perhaps that should have been our default position rather than hysteria.
But we knew that from the outset, and still, nobody led. Just Dan led and Amy, with fear.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and what's this I hear about you and Governor Spaulding not getting along?
Well, I went to his press conference yesterday, and, you know, of course, I asked about the New York Times article. I don't know if you want to go into that, but he said, you know, I'm not running. And then the whole gaggle of reporters like, oh, my, you're going to run. And he's smiling from ear to ear. And then things got a little real when I just asked him. I said, New York and California, they have new mask mandates. Both of their governors, though, have given end dates of January 12th. What about an end date for us?
Here's why we have a mask mandate, because we need to keep people safe. We need to stop pretending that masks don't work. They do. That countless studies show.
And then I interrupted and said, well, we've had, you know, people in Chicago are masked indoors and pretty much outdoors, too. I'd say about 80% wear masks outdoors as well. And we've gone from 300 cases to 1,000 cases a day in Chicago. So that proves to many that masks don't work, right?
Wait, but we went from 300 cases in Chicago to 1,000
Look,
cases a day.
Every time the numbers go down, you say you want everybody to take the masks off. Every time the numbers go up, you say you want everybody to take the masks off. I know what you stand for. Let's keep moving on. I'd like to talk to reporters.
Oh. What do you stand for?
What do I stand? I kept thinking, what do you stand for? That song. What do I stand for? I want freedoms for ourselves.
I don't know anymore. All right, go ahead.
That's what I kept thinking in my head. What do you stand for? No, I stand for freedoms for Illinoisans. And I brought that big map that shows the state, you know, all of America that are free from wearing indoor masks. And it was pissing him off. I mean, literally, and I put it right in front of me. And it's huge, big graphic to show him how the rest of America is living. I want our children to be free from wearing masks. Or I just want parents to have a choice. We don't have choices anymore in Illinois. This, he is a tyrant, and there is no metrics put in place to get us out of this, and he doesn't know how to get us out of this. Nobody does. And if he would just admit, you know, like, you know, we've listened to other, you know, other scientists, we've reviewed other data, let's do this. But he associates me with just being a conservative and selfish, and I don't care about other people, and I want people to die, and I don't. And I wear masks because I have to survive in this godforsaken place called Illinois. Mm-hmm. If I want to see my kids play sports, if I want to coach, and I don't say anything to the kids, I keep it all. I do what I'm supposed to do. I've done everything they've asked, and so have my children, and so have many of us in Illinois, and we just want to have choice.
This is it, boys. This is war. What are we waiting for? I think all your questions should be posed in lyrics from fun songs from this point forward.
I know what you stand for.
Okay.
Well, we know what Jelly Belly stands for. He's a COVIDian because the fear has made his positions popular, at least popular enough for his immediate political interests. And that's what is being served here. Very, very interesting piece by an English writer that sort of speaks and speaks to some of these dynamics. Governor Spaulding is sort of a prime example of the sort of person that Paul Kingsnorth is talking about in his piece, The Vaccine Moment, over at his Substack. And he's thinking about what's happening around the world from his perch in Ireland. I look at news photos of armed, masked, black-clad police stopping people in the streets of Austria to ask for their digital papers. Oh. And I read stories of others arrested for leaving their own house more than the permitted once a day. And I hear Austrian politicians intoning that those who refuse to accede to the injection are to be shunned and scapegoated until they acquiesce. Then I watch interviews with ordinary people, and they say the unvaxxed had it coming. Some of them say they should all be jailed, these enemies of the people. At best, the anti-vaxxers are paranoid and misinformed. At worst, they're malicious and should be punished. Mm-hmm. Then I look across the border at Germany. I see that in Germany, politicians are also considering interning the vaccine hesitant and are currently discussing forced vaccination upon every citizen. By the end of the winter, says Germany's refreshingly honest health minister, Germans will be vaccinated, cured, or dead. There is apparently no fourth option. Wow. Vaccinated, cured, or dead. That's the position of the COVIDian, even though there's no such thing as being cured, as we see from the vaccine's performance. Mm-hmm. They've been busy in Germany. Recently, they put up fences in Hamburg to separate the bad on vax from the good vaxed at the Christmas markets outdoors. Mm-hmm. I'm watching all this from Ireland, the country which has the highest adult vaccination rate in Western Europe at over 94% of the population. At the same time, curiously, we have some of the highest COVID infection rates in Western Europe, too. Government has not been able to explain that fact. But it's a trend that's recently manifested itself in some other highly vaccinated places, too. Gibraltar, Israel, West Flanders. High levels of vaccination do not seem to correspond with low levels of disease, often quite the opposite. But how does Jelly Belly explain that? I know what you stand for. Right, because this is all to be viewed through a political lens. We're using COVID to prosecute our political differences with one another writ large, not about public health, not about science, writ large. And that's what Pritzker's doing.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Which is why, in part, it won't end almost under any circumstances.
No, it'll never end.
Until there's enough people who are just fed up with this and they move on to another niche issue.
Like what, climate change? Because that's getting old, too.
And I'm talking about mainly in urban centers and, you know, the attendant suburban areas of those urban centers. That's really what this is. You're prosecuting political differences writ large. COVID is a proxy. Mask wearing is the proxy within the proxy. Getting vaccinated is another proxy within the proxy.
But here we go. I mean, Air Force discharged 27 service members for refusing COVID-19 vaccines. If you work at Kroger and you're unvaccinated, if you try to call in sick because of COVID, they're not going to pay you. Because it's one of those I told you so moments, says big corporations to the people that work for them. I told you if you didn't get vaccinated, you'd get sick, and we're not going to pay for it.
Going back to Paul Kingsnorth here, I've learned more about human nature in the last 2 years than in my preceding 47. I've learned some things about myself, too, and I don't especially like them either. I've noticed my ongoing temptation to become a partisan, to judge and condemn those on the other side of the question, those sheeple, those malicious enemies of the truth. I've noticed my tendency to seek out only sources of information which confirm my beliefs. Revelation is never comfortable, and he argues we're living in apocalyptic times in the sense of revelation. I agree with that. Most of all, though, what the COVID apocalypse has revealed to me is that when people are frightened, they can be easily controlled.
Yep.
Control, this is the story of the times. We're across the world, we're seeing an unprecedented claim to control staked by the forces of the state in alliances with the forces of corporate capital over your life and mine. All of it converges on the revealed symbol of our age, the smartphone. Enabled QR code that has, with frightening speed in the near silence, become the new passport to a full human life. As ever, our tools have turned on another. They were never our tools to begin with. We were theirs. And so this single fact blows apart. I mean, this dynamic blows apart the fact, blows apart the belief that facts matter. Right? Mm-hmm. Because the vaccines don't prevent the transmission of the virus.
No, they do not.
And so the case for vaccine passports, segregation, lockdowns and the unvaxxed and all such similar measures, what is the point of those? It's not public health. So what is the what's the point? What could the point even believe? He goes on, Kingsnorth, even if you believe the virus is dangerous enough to justify the new radical forms of authoritarianism which have emerged around it, and I certainly don't, those forms will fail anyway if both the vaccinated and unvaccinated people can spread it, which we now know they can. So why? Why are we doing all this? and in increasingly aggressive forms, as we know, in places like Australia, in Germany, in Austria, in Illinois, in California, in New York. Why? Robert, Southwest Side.
Hello?
Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, Amy keeps saying about she's been doing everything with wearing these masks. If people would have stopped complying a long time ago, this would have ended a long time ago. That is the problem. There is no law to wear a mask.
All right, Robert.
In our world. I mean, you can't get into the school. You can't see your kids participate in, you know, orchestra concert or anything. Swimming, nothing. You have to wear a mask.
Elliot, Southside.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just had a comment about my personal experience with COVID. I have cleared the virus in 8 days. I followed the FLCCC, Frontline Critical Care Consortium protocol, established by Dr. Peter McCullough, Joseph Lodapo, who's the Surgeon General of Florida, Pierre Corey. Essentially consists of vitamin D, prophylaxing, which I've been doing for months, vitamin C, quercetin, zinc, and ivermectin. I have COVID-free, 8 days, with next to no symptoms. I'll enjoy my natural immunity.
Thanks, Elliot. Glad you're okay. Okay. Tom, Blue Island.
Dan and Amy, good morning. I would just want to say it seems we've gone beyond the idea of heroes work here and essential and non-essential workers. So I guess that's an accomplishment.
All right, Tom. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to ask your opinion, Dan. It seems like in the society when things go so far in one direction, there's always a pushback. And it's even to a more, I don't want to use the word extreme, but, you know, past to where it was in the past. Do you think that people will ever come to their senses, number one? And number two, do you think the pushback against the state and the regulators will be significant? And do you think we'll see it? Do you think we'll ever see it?
Thanks for the call, Marvin. I don't know. I don't know. It's
I mean, we're going to have more cases, okay? Because this is flu season. COVID is seasonal. And I hope to God they don't do to our kids' schools what they're doing, you know, this adaptive pauses. Because that's around the corner. And stopping sports, canceling games like they're doing in the NFL and NBA. And 97% of the Bulls team is vaccinated. And they have an outbreak of 10 players that have it. No one's sick. One person had a little bit of a cold. What are we doing? The NFL has 78 players that are out. I mean, we're testing healthy people. This has got to stop. And parents got to push back. It is come January. I'm telling you, I have a feeling that adaptive pauses are going to be taking place everywhere.
Okay, well, now address Marvin's question that you've got done with that.
That's the answer to the question.
Are people going to come to their senses?
They better come to their senses.
That wasn't the question.
The question
was,
this is
are people going to come to their senses, and are you going to see a snapback pre-COVID that this regulatory overreach, this COVIDian nightmare, is going to generate such a response that we're going to become a society more skeptical of government and more free than we were before this pandemic? That's the question.
Well, I think that some people have come to their senses and realize what is going on, this overreach of government. And I think other people just like to be controlled. They like the diaper on the face. They like to be told what to do. So is there going to be a revolt in Illinois? Probably not. No.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm pretty skeptical, I got to say, to Marvin's question, that you're going to see the pendulum swing back that far, if at all. I mean, for some people, yes, but we're talking about the macro, what happens to the way we live.
Right.
I mean, partly it will depend on what we do in terms of expressing what we understand has happened over the last 2 years in elections next year. That will be a leading indicator of whether this experiment in representative republicanism is on its way to a bitter end or not. Back to Kingsnorth and his piece. the vaccine moment. The COVID pandemic has proved to be the perfect controlled experiment for the rollout of the next stage of what he calls the machine, the machine's evolution. And he's talking about the allied forces that have all this, that essentially operate as the purveyors of culture that we talk about all the time. K through college, school systems, government, but there, so many of the privates are indistinguishable from the government, and that's a problem. Arts and entertainment, big tech, press corps. That's what he's talking about. This is the missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle without which the rest cannot be deciphered. Their story does not make sense until we understand we're watching a new radical form of techno-authoritarianism unfold before our eyes. It's not an accident, and it's not temporary. In the EU, the smartphone-enabled vaccine passes have been on the card since at least 2018. The entire pandemic war game scenario was war game less than a year before it happened. We talked about that. Yeah. The technology was ready, and the tightening of the ratchet long anticipated. All that was needed was a trigger event. And so it begins. He goes on to say, no conspiracy theory is required for this to be true. It doesn't mean that the virus is not real or dangerous, or that Bill Gates wants to inject you with microchips. Well, he might, but that's a separate conversation. No hidden cabal of people needs to be in control. The people who are in control, or at least who aspire to be, are out in plain sight and have been for years. And most of us either don't notice or don't care. We're too busy playing with the toys they make for us. And what is the line between them and us now? And how blurred is it? What we're doing, what we're seeing is the machine doing what it always does, what I have traced through its history of the past 6 months. It's taking advantage of events to cement its dominance. It's colonizing our societies and our bodies and our minds. It's replacing nature with technology and culture with commerce. It is making us parts in its operational matrix, and it is using our fear to justify its tightening grip. We are afraid. We welcome control. We welcome authoritarianism. We welcome strong leaders who will save us by excluding them. We willingly give up our freedom for safety and end up with neither. Our fear leads us by the hand toward the next stage of our long journey away from Earth and into artifice, away from human freedom and into the digital net, the metaverse, if you will. Yeah, I think what he's describing is what's happening. And whether or not we claw our way back from this next stage that he's describing, I don't know, but I'm skeptical. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Oh, Lord, I'm still not sure. Yeah, there it is. You should, like I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, Amy, get a boombox and have that song playing as, like, your theme music when you walk into the next press conference with Governor Spaulding.
I can borrow one from John Kasich.
I like it.
Yeah.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Bucktown neighborhood in Chicago, which has seen a doubling of carjackings year over year, 2021 versus 2020.
Because it's close to the highway and easy getaway.
Bucktown Neighbors Association is reportedly contracting with a private security firm with offices in both Downers Grove and downtown, a private security firm called P4, to provide nightly patrols of the neighborhood in response to said carjackings and other crime in Bucktown. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line, particularly for city denizens. Is that something that you would contribute to, or city business owners, something you'd contribute to add private patrols to whatever Chicago police presence you're getting in your neighborhood?
Yeah, the security guards are going to patrol the area between Armitage, North Damon to North Avenue to Polina. And, you know, they'll be getting patrols in the early evening. They could last past midnight, but the hours are going to change depending on the season. You know, it's going to be 65 degrees tonight. There's probably going to be a lot of shootings. They might stay out later. But we don't know all the details of their plan because they're keeping it private because they don't want the thugs to know what their plan is, if you know what I'm saying.
The Bucktown Neighbors Association is also sort of keeping a low profile. Nobody is really coming forward to talk about this. And of course, they're starting to get interest because of what they're choosing to do against what has been happening in Chicago for a long time, but particularly spiking over the last 2 years and particularly this year.
And if you're a Chicago police officer, is this okay with you? Does this sit well with you? Are you happy to have extra security, or do you think it might be detrimental? I mean, what are their rules of engagement?
Well, again, you're talking about, in many cases, according to this memo that was obtained by Block Club Chicago, there are going to be off-duty police officers are going to be the private security guards.
Okay.
Which is not unusual.
No.
Just like off-duty security guards provide security for businesses and restaurants and bars and so forth. So that's not surprising. They don't have arrest powers. They are licensed to carry guns. And so essentially they'll use their judgment, their professional judgment, in any interaction they may have with anybody committing a crime or victimized by a crime. That seems to be the case. But, this is not without potential pitfalls.
Right.
Knowing based on uniform, knowing who is the good guy and the bad guy, if there's some sort of row on the street. I'm a proponent of this, generally speaking, but I'm just saying there are questions that need to be asked and answers. There are sort of protocols that need to be clear. And I assume, but I don't know, I hope they're communicating with Chicago police about what they intend to do.
Well, CWB Chicago, I was surprised their take on this. They said, we said it a dozen times. If you think police are bad, wait till you have to deal with a private security company with no oversight, no training requirements, no hiring review, and no transparency. Bonus, they're being paid to look out for someone else's interests.
Well, right. Yes, right. He who is paying is getting the protection. And there may be some residual benefit for others who are not paying, the sort of the free rider issue. However, exigent circumstances call for, unusual responses. And this is an indication of how bad things are in Bucktown, as we know, and so many other parts of the city. And so if you're a resident and you're locked in to staying in Bucktown, and you want to be safe, and you don't feel like Chicago police are able to do their job, the Cook County prosecutors are going to keep criminals off the streets, and you want another layer of protection, I can't blame those people.
Remember when Gold Coast did this about 3 years ago? They had a private security firm guarding some rich people's houses, probably Governor Pritzker's. And then, I can't think of his name, the CEO of the Chicago Cubs. Oh, my God, what was his name? He had private security on his house, around his house, too, because he had a stalker. But then those patrols did the whole year. They went around Blaine. They were there, and everybody in the neighborhood knew who they were. It's extra security detail.
Yeah, this was Theo Epstein and company.
Thank you, Theo Epstein.
Yeah, so right. And so by the way, Lightfoot has what essentially turns out to be private security. It's just we pay for it.
Right.
She has private security detail. These politicians have private security details. So many of them do. I understand, there's going to be some inequities and there's some questions that need to be answered and there's some legitimate concerns that should be addressed. And it sounds like that in the memo, the sort of FAQ memo that Block Club Chicago obtained, that some of that conversation was happening between the Bucktown Neighbors Association and this security firm. So good. There's nothing is perfect. But if you're a resident who says, number one, I don't trust what I'm seeing from the taxpayer-funded entities like the mayor's office, the police department, the Cook County State Attorney's Office, I don't trust that. I'm not seeing the level of protection I expect in my neighborhood. And number two, I don't want to be put in a situation. Maybe I can defend myself. I don't want to be put in a situation to do something that I otherwise don't want to do. You can, you know, legitimately defend yourself and it can still be life altering, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to be put in that position. So I've got the resources. I'm going to hire somebody to help, or we're going to come together as a group of neighbors and we're going to hire some people to help. What's wrong with that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line, John Piatone.
Hi there. Well, my opinion on this is what for? All the way from the citizens groups on to the hired help to the Chicago Police Department, why bother? Because all of these criminals are going to make it up to Kim Fox. And at that point, nothing will be done.
John, but
police officer. Yeah, go ahead.
But John,
ahead.
First of all, these private security guards don't have a power to arrest, so they're not going to be arresting anybody. And secondly, this is coming from a place of assuming that Kim Fox is going to provide no help in getting these people off the street. I still need protection from them when I'm here.
Okay, so again, what for? What's going to stop them? Because the criminals are going to know these are rent-a-cops, basically. I'm a former police officer, so I have an opinion on this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're not going to be afraid of them. They're just going to pummel the hell out of them.
Well, we'll see.
For?
But that's what for is because, as I just said, if I don't want to defend myself or I'm unable to defend myself, that's one more layer I didn't have the day before.
I agree. And then when you hurt the offender, oh, my God, he sues and takes everything you've got. So back to what for?
Well, then why do we have private security firms? No, I understand what you're saying, but then why do we have private security firms? You could say the same thing for off-duty cops that are contracted out to stand guard at a restaurant or a business.
Or a bar.
Yeah. Or a bar.
Yes, and the city will not stand behind them.
No, I know, but the private security firm were. That's the part of their business model, so they have to have insurance.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like
John
said,
doesn't like the idea.
Oh no, not at all. I mean, I've been there, you know. So it just doesn't work.
Well,
I mean,
but can't they detain them until
policing.
The cops come here?
Well,
detain them until the cops come.
Right.
Well, John, I agree. You need to get back to proper policing, and you need these civilian authorities that will back the police so they can do their jobs. But we don't have that in Chicago. So in the meantime, I have to live right now in the city. What am I to do?
The power of the vote.
Well, I can't. We've
long stretches of time between elections, and we have to protect ourselves. I would do it if I had the means and the money and could kick in. I'm sure the residents and the businesses are kicking in for this private security firm.
Thanks
and
for
it
the
starts
call,
tonight. You know,
look, yeah, right. Starts tonight. I appreciate that, you know, John's perspective as a police officer. And again, this is not a perfect solution. I don't think I assume the Bucktown neighbors that have chosen to do this, they're not exactly celebrating that they have to take the action they think they need to take here. But it's sort of the reality. Like,
well, it's
again,
similar to Mayor Lightfoot saying, if you own a high upscale business, hire your own security guard to man the door. So
right.
they did that. They're just doing it as collectively as a neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah, and
everyone's
again,
out for themselves. Got to protect yourself.
Kim Fox should do this. Lori Lightfoot should do that. David Brown should do another thing. You can vote. You can do this. If you can't immediately leave and you have to live there, and you don't want to, you know, again, be standing on guard 24/7, then to me, and you have the resources, and you can collaborate with neighbors. This, to me, is a completely rational response to what's happening in the city. It's a rational response from people who want to live in peace. I regret that more people don't have those resources.
Yep.
And I also regret that more people in Chicago aren't rational such that we let the city get to this place. Tina in Joliet.
Hi, guys. So I understand where the neighborhood is coming from, but this might be an instance in which you see Kim Fox actually prosecute a crime, because what's going to happen is, what is private security going to do to stop them unless they're willing to get physical?
They are.
Unless they're
they
willing
will.
To lay. Yeah, exactly. And what do you think is going to happen? You're going to City Hall is going to rain down holy hell on private security and vigilantism the minute that happens. I understand. There's a part of me that's very, you said that the Bucktown residents are being very quiet and doing this kind of under the radar. Yeah, of course they are, because they all voted for Lightfoot and Jim Fox, and now they have to, this is kind of an affront to their policy.
Well, there's no question. There's no question about that. But
how this ends well.
Well, I don't know if it was. Thanks for the call, Tina.
We don't know.
Two things. One is, people are getting what they voted for. I agree, but your ignorance shouldn't be a death sentence. I'm still not cheerleading for people who are otherwise law-abiding to get killed, even if they're idiots, number one. Number two, it doesn't end well. You have some sort of altercation. You have some security guard stop a criminal. Maybe shoot a criminal, maybe shoot and kill a criminal, and maybe use lethal force legitimately. And then this, then you're going to have the politicians, the Lightfoots and the Kim Foxes, invoking the memory of Bernie Getz and so on. Well, maybe you have to have some sort of event like that. And I hope nobody gets killed, but some sort of event where a private actor is doing what the public actor should be doing. And if you want to go after the private actor for doing the job that you won't do to provide safety for Chicago residents, well, then let's have that citywide debate. I mean, again, off-duty police officers, I know there's questions about training and all this, but you're talking about probably mostly off-duty police officers or retired police officers. They have been trained. They know the lines. And the private security company has to ensure their operation. Does it mean that they can run afoul of the law? No, of course not. Does it mean that they'll have a target on their back from the political authorities in this city? Yes. But I still come down on the side of those Bucktown residents. Again,
me too. I mean, they don't want to pay high property taxes and then pay for this, but they're trying to save their lives, loved ones' lives.
Tell me what is a fail-safe, risk-free response to what is happening in Chicago? There isn't one.
There isn't. Got to arm yourself.
Clay and Wheeling.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Yes, Dan, you are correct. There is no response to this, and hiring this private security company to come in, it's a fallacy. When I worked downtown, we did a job at Lake and Laramie. They hired private security. They had two or three of them on that job constantly. They were either driving around or they were on foot patrolling. The gangbangers in that area would break into the job, break out the back window, and then they even beat and robbed one of the guys. Not once, but twice. This private security is nothing more than piss in the wind. It's nothing. It's nothing. And if I was the honest solution to this problem in Bucktown, is I would stop paying my taxes. My mayor just told me that I need to hire private security. Are you kidding me? Stop paying your taxes. See how fast things really shake up in Chicago.
Thanks for the call, Clay. Yeah, maybe. Where's that enough is enough coalition Joe Perillo wants to start? Yeah, let's get that jump started. We've been talking about for the last 2 days. Jim, Southside.
Morning. How you doing?
Morning.
I'm a retired Chicago police sergeant, and when I was a patrolman, I worked in the 18th District for some time. And at that time, they still had certain stores. I'm not going to mention their names, but they had a policy where they did not arrest shoplifters. They called the police to make a report, and there was times we ran out there, got the guy, fought with him, brought him back, and, we don't sign complaints. And they had statistics which showed that they're not going to do this because the probability of being sued and losing money that way is much higher than just the loss of what
wow.
they were taking. So that was one thing. And then they also had another time where they had a private security guard in one of the stores, which was like 2 a.m. And he used force to lock the guy up. But then it was deemed that he used too much force, and he ended up getting arrested by Chicago police. Ugh. It's a catch-22 situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's private security, because they don't have respect for law enforcement, which is even something more threatening to their freedom. They don't care anything about private security. Look at them as a rent-a-cop and somebody that they don't need any respect with. So then the private security is going to have to go up a higher level, which is going to have to use force, and then that force is going to be deemed as excessive, and then they're going to be charged, and it's going to be an endless cycle of keep on stealing, keep on doing until they start prosecuting people and putting a dent into the crime. Nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change, in my opinion.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, I agree. It's a catch-22. But if somebody wants to, you know, the resident's perspective, it's a catch-22 to be a resident of Chicago, too. And somebody wants to put themselves, I can pay somebody to put themselves between me and that element. Why wouldn't I do it?
Right.
If I don't think that the civilian authorities are going to provide the resources to keep people safe, keep me safe, keep my family safe, keep the neighborhood safe. Why wouldn't I do it? It's a business opportunity for, this is why we have private security firms. Mike in Hammond.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, a lot of your callers are kind of missing the point. The one guy kind of hit on it with stop paying taxes, but these people are desperate. The citizens are desperate. If they're not protected, the next step is leave. You think,
right.
You know, you talk tax dollars. Next step is leave. I don't blame them. What are you going to do?
Right. Well, thanks for the call, Mike.
You know,
I even
asked our family, I go, what's the final straw? One of us gets shot at, carjacked, house broken into, purse robbed, head smashed in on the street like they did to three women within 20 minutes on Southport, right by, you know, in our hood.
Mm-hmm.
What's the final straw?
Well, I guess that
families are asking that question now.
Yeah, I think, I think they are.
I have 1 year left that I have to stay here, but no, do I have to stay here? I mean, every time my kids take the train, it's just, and they take the train to and from because we don't have school buses. It's just, it's nail biting. Living in this city is so difficult mentally and physically. It is all, it's very difficult.
Frank, Arlington Heights.
Chicken's good. I like chicken. That, of course, you may remember, Dan. It's my favorite line from any of the Death Wish movies, Charles Bronson. As Paul Kersey, I think that was in Death Wish 2 when he's dating the new lady after, you know, his wife and his daughter died in the first one. But if he was alive, Death Wish 6 would probably take place right here in Chicago. It really would.
Frank, my favorite Charles Bronson Death Wish has nothing to do with Charles Bronson or Death Wish, but it's the Simpsons episode where they go to Bronson, Missouri. And
rather than Branson. Yeah.
And where everybody in Bronson, Missouri looks like and talks like Charles Bronson, including the kids. So a baby says to his mom, "Hey, Ma, how about some milk and cookies?" And the mom says, "No dice." And the kid says, This ain't over. We got to get that clip. We got to get that clip.
Was his friend Wildy in that? I never saw that Simpsons thing.
All right, we'll give an instant request for Frank from Arlington Heights. We'll get that for you. Thanks, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We need more political casualties among the COVIDians. Political casualties. This is the way that they'll receive a message from the electorate that politicians generally, that it's time to move on, that we're moving on, and we're going to punish people who don't. Boris Johnson may be the latest high-profile possibility. The UK PM there. It has been recently discovered that in December of 2020, a year ago.
It feels like 10 years ago, doesn't it?
It does.
That was a year ago? Okay.
A few dozen of the prime minister's staffers hosted a festive gathering at 10 Downing Street. The Daily Mirror had a report claiming officials knocked back glasses of wine during a Christmas quiz and had a secret Santa while the rest of the country was forced to stay at home. Partygate has only got messier since. Last week, ITV published a leaked video of Downing Street staffers laughing about the party just a few days after the get-together supposedly took place.
Sickening. It's the old rules for thee, but not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but...
Now former press secretary Allegra Stratton jokes with staffers the fictional party was a business meeting and it was not socially distanced. Uh-huh. Then over the weekend, the Mirror published photos that showed Johnson hosting a Zoom quiz on December 15th, a few days before the party in question. Johnson was next to his aides, who were decked out in festive gear. Staffers were still in the office, huddled by computers, conferring on questions and knocking back wine and beer from a local store. Tuesday, Daily Mirror followed up with a report that said email showed staffers were planning to participate in the virtual quiz in the office. After the quiz wrapped up, one staff member instructed attendees to get the message out to go out to the back. And that's where the festivities occurred.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This has drawn a response from Neil Oliver. You've heard him on this show before, played excerpts from his commentaries before. He's a journalist and commentator for GB News in the UK. And this is his take on the Bojo Christmas party, but also sort of the larger state of play in the UK.
Think about those Christmas parties of 2020 when fear among the general population had been pushed to its greatest height by reports of big numbers, the NHS apparently at breaking point, folk on their doorsteps on Thursday nights waving anxiously at the neighbours. How are you doing? Are you all right? While beating pots and pans with spoons and clapping for carers, some of whom have either been sacked already or shortly will be on account of saying no to vaccines. Kids off school for months on end, missing out on everything. Think about all that, driven by fear, stoked by the media and the government, and remember how they partied and drank and danced cheek to cheek and laughed. I read reports last week about a party in the offices of the Sun newspaper, one among many in that trade, I ventured to guess, and so deduced that they were without fear too. And while I'm on the subject of the press and the media, how about we get to know as soon as possible which journalists representing which media were at those parties, living up the one minute and then the following day sitting down to write more fear-laden copy about how we were all about to kill Granny. And then look at us now, getting on for 2 years into it all now. Another Christmas to be crippled and crumpled by more of the same fear-mongering from on high. Straight-faced, despite their own partying, they've whipped up tighter restrictions. In Scotland, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's pre-Christmas gift to the ailing hospitality industry is her advice to one and all to cancel any plans they might have had for Christmas parties. Advent this year has been not about the coming of Jesus Christ, but the coming of Omicron instead.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
If people even know what Advent is.
I like the point that he makes throughout his commentary, not just the fear-mongering that they do, that's well-established, but their hypocrisy is indicative that they have no fear. So it's almost like, well, what do you know? So, yes, it's hypocrisy because they're telling you and forcing you to do one thing while they do something else. But it's also a tell. This is so bad. This is so dangerous. The risk profile is the same, regardless of age or underlying health. You know, all of the propaganda that has been promulgated and continues to be so horrible. And yet here I am at the French Laundry if I'm Gavin Newsom. Here I am going to my health club if I'm de Blasio. Here I am getting my hair cut if I'm Lightfoot. Here I am having a Christmas party if I'm Bojo and his staffers. So how afraid are we? Not very. Why is that? Because there's nothing to be afraid of.
And they know that. And that's why if you go on the fifth floor, walk around Lightfoot's office before a press conference, no one on her staff is wearing masks. No one social distancing. It's as if COVID never happened.
Brian in Oak Forest.
What's up, man? I've said it for, you know, a year and a half, nearly 2 years now. This trash only stops when the people say it stops. And apparently people aren't fed up yet. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Some are. You know, some are. But, I mean, again, where, you know, all of the barbarians, the unsophisticated who pretend to be sophisticated because they have college degrees and they
rich
get paid
husbands.
And they make, and they have rich husbands or they make good money one way or the other. Right. They make good money. That's who the intelligentsia. And I say that with tongue in cheek is the problem.
No, this this stops when it's not advantageous to Democratic politicians anymore. That's when this stops.
Well, to politicians generally, including the likes of Bojo across the pond. This piece from Matthew Walther in The Atlantic now, owned by Steve Jobs' widow. You know, it's a left publication.
Right.
And a sentimentalist one at that. Matthew, what this is drawing, this piece is drawing a lot of pushback to The Atlantic from those who read it, who don't read it just to understand the thinking of the other side like I do. Matthew Walther talking, and he lives in rural Michigan. Where I live, no one cares about COVID. Outside the world inhabited by the professional classes is in a handful of major metropolitan areas. Many Americans are leading their lives as if COVID is over.
Wow.
That is revelatory, shocking, and offensive to Atlantic readers and to the very people he's talking about, the professional classes in a handful of major metropolitan areas. That's who's driving all of this, the persistence of it, in spite of all the evidence, in spite of all the hypocrisy. It's this small group of people in a relatively small slices of the country. He's absolutely right. In November, my wife asked me whether I'd seen the article with the remarkable headline, "Is it safe to go to Thanksgiving dinner?" I asked, "Is that from last year?" She said, "No, it's a few days old." These people, she said, yes. And he goes on from there to tell a story that you have told to us, you and the listening audience have told to us, and we've told to you. We know this. Mark in the Western Burbs.
Yeah, Dan and Amy. Hi, this is Mark. I wanted to say that I got an answer to Joe Perillo's Enough is Enough. And it really starts with starting with the end in mind. And the left has been fantastic at dividing us, and COVID is keeping us apart. But Joe, I think, needs to put together a meeting and come up with what are the things that are on the table, and let's start figuring out a strategy to attack them one at a time.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, good morning. I haven't worn a mask in a store in probably 6 weeks, 8 weeks now. I don't walk in Walgreens with one or Mariano's, nothing. Nobody says a word to me. I think it's just kind of interesting that you just walk around and you go to the checkout. Nobody says a word to me. I think people ought to just take the freaking masks off and take back their freedom and just do it. Nobody, I mean, if no one's going to say anything, why wear the goddamn thing?
Thanks for the call.
Wow, just swearing like a trucker. Well, the thing is that, I mean, I saw the most grotesque thing yesterday, again, because I live by all these daycare centers where they hold the rope and wear their masks. But parents, like, pushing their kids on a swing outdoors, and the parents are wearing masks, and they have their three-year-olds masked up. I mean, it's not, this is a subculture now. This is not normal behavior.
Hey, Zivko in Park Ridge, call back. Zivko, who was from a communist country, he just had a drop-off. I want to hear his perspective. So call back, Zivko, Park Ridge.
Zivko, Jim, call back now.
Jim in Algonquin.
Hey, Dan. Hey, I just want to know where all the lawyers are. I mean, I'm getting ready. You know, tomorrow's the first day that my employee's going to require me to take a test because I'm unvaccinated, but yet nobody else has to, even though the last few cases in the office have all been, you know, from vaccinated people. Mm-hmm. But who do I turn to? I mean, who can I go to say, you know, enough's enough?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of litigation, and there are a lot of lawyers that are taking up these cases. Liberty Counsel, Matt Staver and Liberty Counsel, they're asking Federal District Court in Illinois to certify an entire class of healthcare workers to seek damages on behalf of those employees who were unlawfully discriminated against and denied religious exemptions by the North Shore University Health System here in Illinois.
The one thing I haven't heard anybody talk about,
example,
too. So, you know, being unvaccinated, I'm excluded from certain meetings. I can't travel. I can't do certain things. You know, obviously that's got to affect my long-term career plans with, you know, my company. So, you know, where's that discrimination fit in as well?
Did you try for a medical or religious exemption?
I've not.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to. I mean,
the religious exemption is the way to go, because otherwise, if it's just like it's going to negatively impact my professional development, well, the employer has the law on his side there. So that's a much tougher case to make out in court than a religious sure. exemption. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jim. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Key and Kite Media is one of these outfits that translates research into videos. And they did a good one on the D.C. press corps coverage of everything from COVID to crime in 2021. You know, the year that was in media coverage. Some good examples of how COVID has been covered, miscovered, by the D.C. press corps so that it may be misremembered from so much of the populace.
Okay.
For example, kids going back to school and cases spiking.
A September report from CNN was the stuff of parents' nightmares. It reported that COVID cases amongst children were growing exponentially, with over 750,000 in the span of just about a month. The missing detail? It was the same month that kids were going back to their schools, many of which required testing that they hadn't previously been getting. Meaning it wasn't necessarily a spike in cases so much as a spike in diagnoses amongst kids who, for the most part, felt fine.
The lack of context and consequence in D.C. press corps coverage, because the purpose is not to inform, it's to move, right? They're activists. They have a job to do, to move people's opinions in the direction of the policy choices they desire.
But that's what they're doing right now with the NBA cases and the NFL and the NHL. They're not saying, oh, but by the way, only 1 in 10, let's say, of the Bulls players has a cold. Everybody else is absolutely asymptomatic and feel nothing. But they just scare you. They don't tell you, you know, is anybody hospitalized? No, no one's hospitalized. None of the NFL, NBA, NHL players are hospitalized. But they miss that out.
They also don't tell you that despite the 97% vaccination rate, the NBA has already eclipsed last year's total number of players and coaches that have entered the COVID protocol. Mm-hmm. They don't tell you that either because, again, that doesn't fit their desire for your misunderstanding of the world around you. Give you another example that they provided, a couple of really good ones they found or they remembered on our behalf. About how all interactions between people who disagree are covered by the D.C. press corps, forced through the racial prism, hate black and white police and, you know, white police, black resident or black citizen. Everything is through a racial prism and everything that's covered where there is white and black is covered as white hates black, systemic racism, discrimination.
2021 also seemed like a year where Americans succumbed to their hatred for one another. And while that was true in some cases, the press often couldn't resist the temptation to understand every story on those terms. Maybe you saw the horrifying viral video of a white cop planting drugs on a black suspect in Wisconsin.
I got you on camera, bro.
But you might not have seen the footage from the cop's body cam, which revealed that the baggie belonged to the driver of the car.
That's on their body cam that they took it off of them, so.
And was empty. By the way, no one was arrested for drugs or anything else. The result of the stop was a speeding ticket. Perhaps you were disgusted by the reports of a fan at a Colorado Rockies baseball game who repeatedly harassed a black player with the use of the N-word, a story that was reported as fact in some of the country's biggest news outlets. You might not have caught the quieter follow-up coverage, which revealed that the guy was just shouting at the Rockies mascot, Dinger.
Mm-hmm.
I remember. remember that one.
So many stories. That was Lewis Brinson, the Marlins, was the player that supposedly was the subject to racial epithets that that didn't exist, did not happen. And, I mean, of course, we're just days removed from the verdict in the Jussie Smollett case, as if we need more examples of what this production company provides. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Brendan O'Neill. He is the chief political writer for Spiked Online. Brendan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys.
Let's start with COVID, too. We were just talking about the situation Bojo finds himself in with all of the reporting done about this Christmas party that was held last December at 10 Downing Street, and what that implicates in terms of, well, so many things, not just the hypocrisy piece, but as we were discussing, it seems to me, Neil Oliver made this good point, that it's not only the hypocrisy, it's also the idea, what does it convey about how afraid they are? So they're pushing fear, but they are not afraid. So what does that tell you about how afraid you should be?
Yes, I think that is the fundamental question. I mean, there is the hypocrisy angle. So, I mean, the parties, there was more than one party. There seemed to have been a string of social gatherings in Downing Street and other Conservative Party buildings at a time when it was illegal for the rest of us to meet just one other person for social reasons. That had been completely banned, and yet they were having lively, crowded parties with drinks and food. It's almost like they are this decadent elite. You know, it's like the fall of Rome, where these people are sitting around, drinking wine and having a great time while the world around them collapses, according to their own narrative. So it has shocked the public. But you're right. The broader question here is, why are they behaving in this way, looking very happy, rubbing shoulder to shoulder, at a time when they told the rest of us that if you go outside, if you socialize, you might get sick, you might kill an old person, you might cause calamity to befall the nation? So they were promoting this ceaseless message of doom and dread and fear, while behind the scenes they were being very relaxed and feeling very comfortable in each other's company. So the disconnect between the narrative of fear that they promoted and the way they behaved, I think that raises enormous questions about the COVID era.
Yeah, but do you think he'll pay for this politically? Boris Johnson?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, some of them already are paying politically. So, for example, Sean Bailey, mm-hmm. who was the Conservative Party's candidate for the mayor of London, a very close associate of Boris Johnson, he has had to resign from one of his positions because a photo has been published today showing him at a very crowded party at a time when he was tweeting that you must not socialize, you must not visit your family, you must not visit your friends. So he was tweeting this publicly last year while he was having parties with his friends in which they are very closely packed together in a small room. So he's already paid for that with one of his positions. And Allegra Stratton, who was Boris Johnson's spokeswoman, she's also had to resign because a video was leaked showing her laughing about the Downing Street parties and openly admitting that they had not been socially distanced. Whether Boris will pay a price himself, I think it's possible he will. I mean, I think every political party in this country now will be going for Boris on precisely this angle. The fact that he tells us to do one thing, but he does another thing entirely. He makes laws that punish people to an extraordinary degree for socializing, while he and his friends appear to have been socializing themselves. So I think lots of parties will go for him on that front, and I think they could have some success.
It seems to me that this doesn't change in countries or states that are beset by COVIDian politicians until they face political repercussions, until they're removed from office, and removed from office on this basis. So Andrew Cuomo gets removed from office. The perception is going to, at least among some, those more inclined to believe the COVID propaganda, sexual harassment and his boorish behavior towards women. So it wasn't his complete mishandling of the virus. It's got to be sort of litmus test. We remove them because of what they did. And the impact that it had, in addition to their hypocrisy and all sorts of other things. But it's got to be COVID related. And that sends a message through the ecosystem that says, well, this is over unless you want to continue it at the expense of your political career.
Yes, I think that this is one of the things that concerns me about the revelations of all these parties that were taking place. I mean, it's very interesting. And looking at these photos, it's very shocking. And the country is talking about it. This really has cut through to ordinary people. They are really horrified by what government officials were doing. But at the same time, I think the broader discussion has to be about whether COVID authoritarianism is a good idea at all, and whether lockdown was a good idea, and whether you know, shutting down society, shutting down the economy, suspending civil liberty, suspending democracy itself, all these actions that we took in the UK over the past 21 months, and most other countries did similar things too, is that a good idea? My answer to that is no. My answer is that that is not a reasonable way to deal with a virus, and there have got to be better ways to deal with a health crisis that don't involve making health worse in other areas, don't involve millions of people losing their jobs, don't involve the collapse of small businesses and the suspension of our freedoms. And that's got to be the broader debate. So I hope it doesn't become myopically focused on the fact that we are ruled by a bunch of hypocrites, which is not exactly news. I hope it becomes a broader discussion about what is the best way to respond to a problem like COVID-19.
What about this other matter, too, per the clips we played? The media's obsession with forcing everything through a racial prism and attending, to propagandize people about systemic racism and whites are oppressors and blacks are oppressed from K-12 curriculum to general society. I mean, Jussie Smollett was not the only racial hoax perpetrated last year. Or this year.
That's right. There have been numerous racial hoaxes in recent years, especially on American campuses, but also in the UK and elsewhere too. And I think the Jussie Smollett case, I think the useful thing about it, if we can put it like that, is that it has brought to public attention just how serious the problem of these hoaxes has become. And I think, you know, when you look at the Jussie Smollett case, firstly, you think it's completely and utterly insane. Who would go to these extraordinary lengths to pretend that they had been attacked, to pretend that they had been racially abused, to hang a noose around their neck and then leave it around their neck until the police came so that they could see it? I mean, these are in some ways the actions of a crazy person. But on the other hand, they make perfect sense because we live in a culture in which victims are celebrated, in which having been the victim of racist abuse will win you a lot of praise and sympathy from the cultural elites, and in which it having gone through that alleged kind of attack will help to bolster the narrative of our times. And the narrative of our times is the hyper-racialized narrative that white people are all problematic and privileged and need to check their privilege, and black people are all oppressed and sad, and they need our help and they need our sympathy and they need our pity. This super racialized way of viewing the world. And I think what that does, it actually encourages people to present themselves as victims, and it even encourages people to set themselves up for attack in order that they can play a role in that narrative that's being created. And I think that's what the Jussie Smollett case really shows us.
And are you surprised that some people actually still believe his story? I mean, you even had Beyonce's mom coming out asking for compassion for Smollett during the sentencing process.
It's extraordinary. I think the other thing that has been revealed this year is that the worth of a victim is now judged according to their identity and according to the identity of the person or the people who allegedly attacked them. So Jussie Smollett will get a lot of sympathy, even now that it's been made crystal clear that he lied. He made it up. He denigrated the serious problem of racism by creating this kind of hoax. He's laughing in the face of real victims of attacks by pretending to have been one himself. Even now, he's still getting that sympathy because he fits the kind of good identity. He is a person of color. He is gay. He is part of the celebrity set, or he was part of the celebrity set. So he's seen as having a good identity. But then if you look at the attack in Waukesha, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that
Waukesha,
correctly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Waukesha. If you look at the way in which that has almost been forgotten and has not become a focal point of torture to discussion or liberal complaints on news networks or people talking about the terrible nature of hatred in America. Why not? Because the person who allegedly carried out that vehicular attack was a person of color and the victims were just white people. I mean, that is how it's seen. You know, they were elderly white ladies, some of them. There was a young white child. And that has not had the same kind of discussion as something like the Charlottesville attack a few years ago, for example, where a horrible right-wing person used his car and killed one person. And that's memorialized as a terrible incident, something that we have to talk about all the time, whereas this more recent attack is kind of almost erased. So the way in which identity politics now even determines how much sympathy we give to people and how much we focus on terrible events in the real world, I think that highlights the inhumanity of identity politics.
Well, and the agitprop from the media drives terrible, ghastly public policy. So COVID, these authoritarian policies we're talking about in this space, a middle school in Newton, Massachusetts had safe spaces for students to process the verdicts in both the Rittenhouse and Ahmaud Arbery cases by race in Denver. So segregated. Denver public schools are promoting racially segregated playtime for equity. So now we have this sort of coverage and this sort of identitarian mentality promoting neo-segregation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the horrific logical conclusion to this politics of identity, to the politics of wokeness, because what this politics is actually doing, it presents itself as this very progressive, liberal, forward-looking form of politics, almost, you know, the heir to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. That's how it presents itself. But actually what it's doing is rehabilitating racial thinking and breathing life back into the racial imagination. So it is always encouraging us to think about things in a racial way. If you're a white person, you have to think about that all the time. I'm a terrible person. I was born with privilege. I was born with the original sin of white skin. And if you're a black person, you're encouraged to go through life thinking, I'm surrounded by structural racism. Everyone is out to get me. Life is going to be incredibly difficult for me. That's the narrative the woke mob pushes all the time. So it encourages us to adopt this hyper-racial view of the world. And the logical conclusion to that racialization of everyday life is segregation, is the treatment of the races in a different way so that they can apparently only cope with certain events like the Rittenhouse verdict if they're on their own, with their own kind, separated off from the other problematic races. This is the really terrible end point of a politics that has actually brought racial thinking back to life. And that's why I think, as someone who is completely anti-racist and thinks you should judge people by character rather than color, I think it is absolutely crucial in 2022 that we really challenge this new woke politics of race.
He is Brendan O'Neill, chief political writer for Spiked. That's spiked-online.com. Brendan, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. White House spokesman Jen Psaki has been quite on a tear this week. Starting with chastising House Republicans who voted against the $4 trillion socialist tax and spendathon, the Build Back Better, as the Biden-istas call it, but not really making the sale with the public. Anyway, here's Jen Psaki's explication of Bidenomics.
You know, you saw every single Republican in the House vote against Build Back Better. What were they voting against? Yes, they were voting against the president's agenda. They were also voting against lowering costs. They were voting against lowering costs for childcare, lowering costs for elder care, lowering costs for health care.
I wish somebody would, in the Republican ranks, would make the argument, would pick up on these sorts of statements and give the American people who don't already get it, a little bit of a lesson in economics 101. Subsidizing something doesn't lower its costs, it increases it. So what the government does is subsidize, increase the cost, and then socialize the payment. But you're not reducing the cost. You're reducing the cost for a certain cohort while you're increasing the overall cost and spreading it out. That's the actual policy. And so if you want to do that, then we can talk about whether or not that makes sense to do. But let's at least be honest about what we're doing. Jen Psaki is preternaturally incapable of being honest. And then yesterday, we get Jen Psaki going after Big Meat.
I know. Oh.
To explain price increases at the grocery store.
There are several progressive groups and lawmakers who are increasingly vocalizing the idea that inflation, high inflation, is being driven by corporate greed, including companies with high profits, some of whom have met at the White House with the president in recent months. Does the president endorse that idea? Does he think that corporate greed is the big driver of inflation right now?
Well, I think that the president thinks the way people across the country, American families, digest inflation is by price increases. And if you look at industry to industry, it's a little different. So, for example, the president, the Secretary of Agriculture have both spoken to what we've seen as the greed of meat conglomerates. That is an area when where people go to the grocery store and they're trying to buy a pound of meat, 2 pounds of meat, 10 pounds of meat. It is the prices are higher. That is, in his view, and the view of our Secretary of Agriculture, because of, you could call it corporate greed, sure. You could call it jacking up prices during a pandemic. There are other areas really where we've seen increases because of supply chain issues, and we're seeing those increases around the world as it relates to gas prices, oil supply, and things along those lines. So I would say there's some areas where we have seen corporations benefit, profit from the pandemic, and certainly the president would agree with that component. I don't know the full context of all of their remarks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, some companies have, but enough about Amazon. You know, if you want to make a charge of price fixing, you want to make a charge of illegal activity, you make a charge like she has made against meat conglomerates,
yeah.
then how about you provide some evidence? I mean, she is just a disgrace, and this happens on the same day that you get the producer's price index up 9.6% year over year. Why does that matter? Because the producer price increases get passed on to the consumer in terms of price increases. Maybe that has something to do with it. And the profligate monetary and fiscal policy of, to some extent, the previous administration as it pertained to COVID, and to the full extent this administration as it pertains to both sides of that financial house. Maybe that has something to do with why steak is up 25% year over year at the grocery store, Jen. For more on this, pleased to be joined by our friend Steve Moore, Trumponomics author, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. Good morning. And, you know, by the way, I worked alongside Jen Psaki for almost a year when I was imprisoned at CNN back in, I think that was in 2017. And, you know, I got to know her a little bit. And go easy. She doesn't know anything about economics. I mean,
okay.
Fair enough.
I mean, she's just parroting. My point is, she's just parroting what, you know, the economic geniuses over at the White House are telling her to say. She's like, she's very much like Biden himself. She's just reading the teleprompters or regurgitating the economic nonsense. Look, it's a big problem for the White House right now. It's melting down. It's a meltdown right now over there. Biden's approval ratings are just sinking like a rock. You're seeing the approval of Big Build Back Better, which is lower every single day as people realize what's in this bill. You are exactly right in terms of the idea that when you subsidize something, its cost actually goes up. I mean, is healthcare less expensive now today than it was before the government got involved with Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare?
Yeah. College education.
Is K-12 education free? No, it's more expensive than ever before. And then, of course, the best example is higher education, where we keep, you know, providing tens and hundreds of billions of dollars to aid the universities. And gee, what's happened to university tuitions? They go up and up and up. Well, and so, and I think I mentioned this last week, this study that I kind of previewed for you guys by Casey Mulligan has really gone viral, showing that, yeah, if you get the subsidies, if you're one of the half of the families that gets child care that gets the subsidies, your costs go down. Guess what? If you don't get the subsidies, your costs are going to go way, way up. Your child care, for some people, if you make more than about $60,000 to $65,000 a year and you're not eligible for the child care subsidies, you're going to pay, by Casey's estimate, about $25,000 a year more this year, or next year, I should say, for a child care. Gee, what a bargain that is. But the good news, again, I think that this bill is in really big trouble right now. You've got high inflation. They can't explain how, you know, another multi-trillion-dollar spending bill is going to reduce inflation. That's a laughable concept. They can't explain their phony numbers. They were using fraudulent budget numbers. And now even Joe Manchin is saying, look, this bill is bad for America, bad for West Virginia. I don't see how they get to 50 votes in the Senate. I don't see how they get there.
I mean, high inflation, this is a 40-year all-time high. Gas up 58%. Yep. Used cars, hope your car doesn't break down. Used cars, 31%. New cars, 11%. And then again, meat, poultry, fish, and eggs are collectively up 12.8%. I mean, you literally get sticker shock when you go to the grocery store, but what is to blame, and when will it end? Because I heard, I think it was Fox saying that this will be done in 2023.
Yeah, Amy, you just didn't get the memo. The way we solve the inflation problem is we pass the Build Back Better bill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we spend another $3 to $4 trillion, and then everything's going to be so much cheaper.
But what did they think was going to happen when they threw thousands of dollars at us during the pandemic?
What's that?
What did they think was going to happen when they threw thousands of dollars at us during the pandemic?
They have turned economics upside down, and they really do. We think we're idiots. They think the American people are idiots, and that we're gonna buy this stuff. You know that they're saying, and it's so laughable. I mean, the idea that spending more money is going to bring inflation down. I mean, that's crazy. You know, if you've got a seventh grade education, you know that's not true. They say, oh, it's going to be free. It's not about something done. You know, you guys remember that old show, the Get Smart show? Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Remember that line that Get Smart used to use, like, missed it by that much? Well, they estimated that it was going to be cost nothing, and it turns out they missed it by that much. No, it's not going to cost nothing. It's cost $3 trillion. Gee, that's a little bit of an error.
No, that's the Congressional Budget Office numbers fake, according to Jen Psaki.
Yeah. When they like the numbers, they herald them and say, see, you know. And then when, of course, the CBO comes out, what happens, just so your listeners know, is they actually started telling the truth. How dare the CBO tell the truth about what this bill is going to really cost? And so this is quite a quandary for them. I'm with Larry Kudlow. I think this bill is a lot of trouble, and it's exactly the opposite of what the Biden administration, the Democrats keep saying, if people just knew what was in this bill, they would love it. No, actually, the more people find out what's in this 2,492-page monstrosity, the more they hate it.
Oh, and by the way, as you know, Steve, the CBO normally undershoots the cost of things.
That's true.
For example, their track record on Obamacare.
Yes. Great point, Dan. And that's a really important point, because Even with their new estimate of $3 trillion over 10 years, we think that's actually an underestimate. We think it's going to be closer to four.
And so you think Manchin holds, and as long as Manchin holds, this thing is done. And also that they have to get it done before Christmas, or just the weight of all this effort to get this done before the end of the year won't be there come the new year?
Well, Dan, I would never bet my life on anything Joe Manchin does.
Okay.
I mean, he's a politician. Sure. He says one thing one day, one thing another. I'm just saying that if you actually read his statement of what he said, I think it was back about 4 or 5 days ago, where he just ripped this bill. I mean, he ripped it, you know, more than I've been ripping it, saying how horrible it's going to be. It's going to make inflation worse. It's going to make the debt worse. It's bad for the West Virginia coal miners. And going on and on and on. I mean, Dan and Amy, how do you actually then end up voting for a bill that you've spent the last 6 months trashing?
One other question before we let you leave. How should we interpret, how do you interpret this huge stock sell-off by corporate titans like Elon Musk? You know, usually you see the CEO of Microsoft, Elon Musk, selling billions of dollars worth of stock, and maybe you start to think they know something about where the market's going that I should know.
Well, I mean, Elon Musk is by the way, I thought it was a great choice making him the Time Magazine Man of the Year. I don't always agree with Elon Musk, but he is an incredible visionary and innovator and entrepreneur. It's incredible. He took a company, Tesla, that was just a concept a few years ago, and now it's a $1 trillion net worth company. That's just incredible, the stuff he has done. And incidentally, I don't know if you saw the tweet from your good friend Elizabeth Warren this morning. I mean, trashing Elon Musk. Oh, he's just a freeloader. Freeloader? Who's freeloader? Now, look, it is true Elon Musk has taken a lot of government subsidies. I will admit that. But who's freeloading here? I mean, this is now a $1 trillion company. And with the 25% capital gains tax and the 25% corporate tax rate, that means the freeloader is the government. The government can take half of that.
Right. He shot back at Warren saying he's a freeloader, saying, you know, don't spend all my tax dollars in one place. Oh, wait, you already have. it's good. And I appreciate his anti-establishment sentiments. But you think this is from Musk and from others. It's not just him. You think this sell-off by them of their stock interests is just a preparation for some tax increases that may be coming in this administration? Or you think it's where they think the market is going when the Fed starts to taper and then interest rates go up?
I think a little bit of both. I'm not optimistic about the stock market right now. I mean, the market's been on an incredible tear for the last 18 months. But I don't know if I'd sell my stocks, but I certainly wouldn't buy into this when we're going into an inflationary era. But it is also true that they are being very cautious about the massive increase in tax rates, and they're trying to sell their assets now before they get taxed at these, punitive rates that are coming in. But I got to tell you, I do think we are going to kill this bill, Dan and Amy. Kill the bill. It's bad for America. By the way, there's four new states that are now looking at abolishing their income tax, and unfortunately, Illinois is not one of them.
All right. Well, that killing the bill would make it a merrier Christmas, that's for sure. Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author, economist. Steve, thanks as always.
Have a great week, guys. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. When Iraqi war veteran Ray Jennings was convicted of killing an 18-year-old college student named Michelle O'Keefe, at a sentencing hearing, he turned to the family of the victim and said, I'm quoting, "As Christ is my Lord and Savior, I will stand before God, and this is one sin that I will not be judged for. I'm at peace in my life. And I laugh and I smile because I hold no remorse because I didn't kill your sister. Jesus is my Lord and Savior, and I will stand before him. And I'll stand before him with you, and with you, and will answer to this question." He spent 11 years behind bars before he was exonerated. This is a case that dates back 15 years, at least as the inception of the crime and the proceedings, two mistrials. Two hung juries, convicted on the third. But it's come to light recently because a young attorney and his father, who took up Ray's case and filed a habeas corpus petition for him while he was imprisoned, have reintroduced it just a few days ago. Clint Ehrlich, this Twitter thread that I came upon telling this incredible story, was just too much to pass up, particularly when we're spending so much time talking about law and order of late and what happens when those in charge of the justice system act in a corrupt manner, which is part of the story in the Ray Jennings matter. We're pleased to be joined now by Ray Jennings, Iraq war veteran who spent 11 years behind bar for a murder he didn't commit. Ray, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, again, we're a few years removed from you being set free now, but walk us through a little bit of the case before we get to some of the takeaways and find out how you're doing now. You were working as a security guard near where the murder occurred while you were studying, I think, for a U.S. Marshals exam, if I'm remembering the Twitter thread properly. And then this killing happened. Police questioned you. You tried to be helpful, and it went from there.
Yeah, so basically in February 22nd of 2000, as you stated, a young lady was shot and killed in her car at a park and ride. I was the unarmed security guard out there that night, heard the shots, called for shots fired to my dispatch, which in turn called for sheriff's department. And, you know, the story just takes effect from there. And it's basically me being thinking I'm being helpful in a situation and giving as much information as I possibly could. And, you know, 2 months short of 6 years later, I was arrested for the murder of this young lady based upon the information that I had provided to law enforcement.
And it turns out, as you get a little bit further on in at least Clint Ehrlich's telling of it, that some of the information you provided turned out to be inaccurate. I mean, you were telling the police, what you saw or you thought you saw. But, for example, you got the caliber of the gun wrong. And other material and other material details that would have suggested, well, wait a second, this is the murderer. He's supposed to know things that only the murderer would know, and he doesn't know them.
Correct, and that was during the trials. The district attorney had a way of putting his words into action and saying, "Don't worry about the things that he got wrong. Think about the things that he got right." And so that's basically what they used against me at my trial. Is basically they took my own words and manipulated those words to fit their storyline, and they came up with their own storyline at that process instead of doing the proper investigation initially, which would have led the detectives to a carload of gang members who were at the parking lot that night. Also, they became or had tunnel vision and said, well, we want Ray Jennings. We can't go after anybody else but Ray Jennings. And then, as you had stated before, there's a lot of political stuff going on in my particular case, where a high-powered civil attorney in the area had got involved in a civil lawsuit, and it was his sole purpose to gain as much information from me and try to manipulate that situation in that wrongful death lawsuit. And he was quoted in saying, you know, I will make sure that Ray Jennings gets, you know, charged for this crime or goes down for this.
This guy's name you're referring to is Rex Paris, who is the mayor of a nearby town, Lancaster, the town next to where the murder occurred. And he represented the O'Keefe family, the family of the victim, in a wrongful death suit against you and the company for which you worked.
This is correct. And with that lawsuit, there was they filed it against three individuals or entities, me being one, the city of Palmdale, and also the security guard company. As far as I know, the city settled for $2 million, and the security company had filed a bankruptcy, which alleviated them, and they just kept pursuing me for $25 million for that wrongful death.
Did they ever find her killer, Michelle O'Keefe's killer?
So that is a touchy subject. Yes, they know who killed this young lady. Has he been arrested or charged? No, he has not.
Why not?
These are questions I can't answer. I have no idea why not. If you want to know my personal views on things, it's more political than anything. There was such mishandling of my case that once they do, if they ever do charge this gentleman, who's currently incarcerated as we speak, if they ever do charge him, and then once all the details do come out, it just puts a black eye on the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. And I think that's the major issue that they have, is they've already had to admit that they made a grave error in not only arresting me, not only charging me, but trying me three times and then, you know, putting me in prison. And I don't think they want to go through that again. And I believe in my humble opinion, that that's the issue.
It's not just L.A. County. It's also the FBI, because to build a case against you, there was an FBI profiler that was brought in.
Correct. Mark Safarik, he came in, and he was the district attorney's star witness as an FBI profiler. And in each one of my trials, he made it very clear to everybody that nobody in the world, except for Ray Jennings, could have committed this murder. And what he basically did was took the storyline from the end, and then he just backed it up, and he put pieces of the puzzle together that made it fit his narrative to say that Ray Jennings was the only one that could have killed this girl.
Do you want him to go to prison for perjuring himself on a witness stand?
Well,
I would love for him to I would love for him to suffer some type of repercussion, as well as the DA's office, the gentleman that prosecuted me, Michael Blake. But, you know, in a sense, these guys are like Elliot Ness, and they're untouchable in a sense. And it's very troubling to know that DA's, district attorneys, or even FBI profilers, they can constantly either try people or take the stand against individuals and come to find out, you know, that their testimony was inaccurate or false. And then the DA also, knowingly, would try somebody with information that has not even been investigated and continue to process, you know, somebody's life and so forth. And then no repercussions are given to these individuals. They're given a slap on the wrist, if that, and saying, okay, we'll go find somebody else to convict then. It's very sad.
And then your third trial, they have the case removed from downtown L.A., and they have it held in a community where, you know, your name had been plastered all over the place as the murderer of this college student. So the first two trials, they have jurors that won't vote to convict downtown L.A. Then they take it to a smaller community where you're labeled. And, you know, in combination with everything else that's going on that you're describing with the FBI criminal profiler, with the mayor who's representing the family in a wrongful death suit, they get a conviction.
This is correct. It made no sense. And again, this has to do with people of power being in the right position to make these type of moves. And the case should have never been moved. It should have never been tried a third time in the first place. But it was moved because the DA knew somebody from, I guess, from his past, and they were able to secure a change of venue. And even when we did a survey, once we got the change of venue, once they got the change of venue, and my attorney had a survey done within the community as far as me receiving a fair and unbiased trial, it came back that I would not receive a fair trial in the community based upon, and for 9 years, my name had been drugged through the media in the front page of the paper. And this was a very prominent case up there. And there was really no hope for me once I got transferred back to the Lancaster-Palmdale area.
Well, Ray, how did God help you through all of this? I mean, 11 years in prison and going through the three trials, it must have been just awful.
You know, my faith is what carried me through. If not for my faith and God, I believe, my life inside of prison and county jail would have taken a different turn. Inside, you know, for somebody like myself who was fighting a case that you know that you didn't kill anybody, and yet now you're thrown into an environment where, especially in L.A., and L.A. It's saturated. All it is gangs. And whether you have white gangs, black gangs, Hispanic gangs, you know, and for somebody like myself, I'm not associated with any type of gangs. And for me to have to be thrown into this environment, and, you know, sometimes what you see on the TV is not so accurate, but sometimes it is. You have a choice. And my choice is I'm going to stand alone. I don't need to join any prison gangs. I don't need your help or anything else like that. And God was the only thing I had to hold on to. I read the word, you know, constantly, and that's all I had. And, you know, I had my bad days. I had, you know, very, very depressing days where, you know, suicide was
at the top of the line, you know, at the top of the list as far as, you know, I want to leave this situation. And it wasn't so much that I couldn't deal with it. It was so much that I wanted to have a conversation with God, with everything that I believe in. You know, I wanted to have this conversation on, like, why are you doing this? Like, why do you put people through stuff like this that we're supposed to believe in you? And, you know, you start questioning God and what his plans are for your life or just in general in the world, you know. And so without that, I would have went down a different path, to say the least.
Your attorney who posted this Twitter thread that I picked up and learned about your case and your story, Clint Ehrlich, writes, "The case also affected me in another deeper way. When it started, I was an atheist. After it was done, I was a Christian. God was the only way I could account for the mysterious force that guided me that night." And he's referring to watching this Dateline story about your case. And he also said, "Or for the courage Ken and Ray showed as brothers in Christ." He's referring to you, obviously, and also Ken Lynch, who was a prosecutor in the DA's office in L.A. County that decided to take up this case after being petitioned by Clint Ehrlich.
Yeah. So when I was released from prison, I stayed with Clint and his mother Nora at their house. And during that time, Clint is a very intelligent young man. He's a scary intelligent. He processes information and data very quickly. And to sit down and play, like we would play Scrabble, you know, Scrabble was my thing when I was locked up. I was, you know, I read the Scrabble dictionary, and I learned how to play Scrabble really well. And him and I would sit up until wee hours in the morning, and we would just talk. And he was so intrigued about my faith and how it carried me through and why I believed and what I believed. And then, you know, when you tell somebody like Clint this, he goes and takes the knowledge and he does the research and he studies for himself. And he had made it clear that he didn't believe in God or a higher power. And there's no explanation for the things and how things happened in my case beyond a divine intervention somewhere. And, you know, I know a lot of people have issues with believing things like that. But in my particular situation, the way that the cards fell and how all this happened, there's no other explanation in my opinion and from my experience than something divine happening. There's just not.
It's been, 5 or 6 years since you were released?
Yes, sir. It's been almost 6 years. June 23rd will be 6 years.
And so what has consumed your time in the last 6 years? How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. You know, there's been some troubling times. I still deal with some of the stuff that I had, I guess, acquired in while I was inside incarcerated. There are certain things that you become accustomed to. And coming back into what's known as the real world, things are a little bit differently. You see things differently. And for me, I've just been, you know, I've gotten married. I've been trying to reestablish and rebuild a relationship with my 5 children. They were very young when I was taken away from them. And excuse me. That always gets home.
Take your time.
And that's been, you know, that's been it's been very charming. Hmm.
I'm sure they're glad to have you back, and it's time that, you know, they can now reconnect with you.
Yeah, I mean, we've been, you know, we spent a lot of time together when I was in California, and, you know, some of my kids have moved to North Carolina and stayed with me for a little while, and, you know, they branched off and went their own directions and stuff. And, you know, it's just been, you know, very trying on that. But as far as my life goes, I've been, you know, I've been living it to the fullest, and I've learned not to take anything for granted. I try not to let too much bother me in life, because nothing can compare to being
thrown in a situation where you're fighting for your life or a murder you didn't commit and realize that everything had been snatched away from you in a heartbeat. So that's basically what's been going on with me. You know, I've just been pushing forward in life and making the best out of it.
Are you pursuing any legal remedies against those individuals that we've discussed who were connected to wrongly imprisoning you?
Yeah, unfortunately, there are no legal avenues that I can take towards whether it be Michael Blake, the prosecutor, Detective Longshore, or Harris, who are the investigators. The only legal avenues I was able to pursue was my defense attorney for incompetent
counsel.
For his representation of me, yes, and then also my appellant attorney. Those two I were able to, you know, seek, which is very sad in a sense because, you know, why are we not able to, you know, seek legal actions towards the people who are actually responsible for this? And so the state of California has a law which is known as Opie's Law, and if you have been wrongfully convicted and have been found factually innocent, and those two words must be present on your appeal, per se, to receive any type of compensation from the state of California, you have to be factually innocent, proven factually innocent. And in my particular situation, I was proven factually innocent. Everything about this case points to this other gentleman. Everything points to this other gentleman. And the detectives failed to do their case or failed to do their job in my particular case at that time.
Well, Ray Jennings, you've been dealt some rough cards in life. I'm glad you're still standing and life is obviously better for you. Ray Jennings, Iraq war veteran, served our country in Iraq in addition to everything else he's experienced. 11 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit. Ray, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your story. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you guys for having me. Y'all have a blessed day and take time to look around and enjoy it.
Yes, and thank you, Ray, for sharing your story. We appreciate it. God bless. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Pandemic, when we're free, there's a life I remember full of activity. Somewhere past the pandemic, masks will come off. No more need for a nose swab every time we cough.
Those are the soulful stylings of former NIH Director Francis Collins, Dr. Francis Collins, offering that on an HHS virtual town hall.
Oh, really?
Who knew he was so talented? I wish he would have gone into folk music and not medicine, or at least public health, as it turns out. More soulful stylings, not necessarily in song form, we're pleased to be joined again by Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute and author of the book Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Man, my pleasure. But that clip you played was real? That wasn't the Babylon Bee?
No, it's real.
That was really real?
That's real. Francis Collins.
Oh, my gosh.
That was Francis Collins.
Francis Collins.
Yeah. And he's a paradigmatic case of one of these lockdown guys who is sort of sneaking away from public life, pretending like he didn't do anything and just...
Right, turning to his music. Yes, right. I mean, it really is. It really is. Like, because I know you wrote this piece, like, who's going to be held accountable for all this?
Yeah.
Francis Collins wants you to remember him for his music.
Yeah, it's so disturbing, you know, that we could have had, you know, a fire set to civilization like this, and we don't have anybody we can really sort of say, oh, look, you did it, or nobody's willing to take responsibility. I made the decision. It's all these vague committees and bureaucracies and best practices and precedents and, you know, germ games and vague academics. And people, you know, were glad to say, well, I really didn't approve of the way this happened. I didn't like the way this came down. That was a true mistake. You know, they really messed that one up. You can't find anybody out there willing to say, look, I love these policies and I think they were really good. And if you don't like them, blame me. Right? You just don't hear anybody saying that.
It's been this dynamic since the beginning, right? The politicians say, I'm following the science and data, and the medical experts, and the medical experts say, I'm just providing advice and counsel to the politicians. So nobody has to be held accountable for anything that goes wrong.
I'm just a scientist. I'm not into politics. Actually, Fauci said this a number of times. He said, well, I'm just here promoting public health. I'm not here to tell the politicians what to do.
And he's made millions off of this pandemic. So have politicians. You know, if you look at Chris Cuomo and everybody, but here in Illinois today, I don't know if you know this, we're celebrating the 1-year anniversary of the first COVID vaccination in Illinois. I mean, they'll do anything to have a press conference to keep this going and to keep, you know, their faces on TV screens here in Chicago.
You know, I'm truly worried about the future of vaccinations. I mean, you know, here you had a great, great, great achievement of public health, the number one achievement of public health in the last century, if not of all time. And it's now just all mired in this mucky, mucky thing with, you know, excessive profitability on the part of the farm companies, the lack of therapeutics. There's a discrediting of vaccinations that is taking place. That cannot be good in the long run. You know, it almost seems like a big plot to promote the anti-vax movement or something.
Also, too, what about therapeutics? We're talking about therapeutics again now. It's been a while, but we're talking about them now because Pfizer's Paxlovid, the results 90% effective at reducing the risk of hospitalization and death in high-risk individuals that were tested. And so if that's the case, and then we don't have to worry about infection anymore, you just take this pill and others, but this is the one that the public health establishment might actually sign on to. Then isn't it over?
I don't understand why it's not over. It's you know, when that pill was announced, I thought, well, that's good, that's good. Of course, am I right that it's going to be a patented proprietary product and therefore overpriced? I mean, I don't know that, but there's going to be plenty of over the counter solutions to coronaviruses, you know, that's sort of what you do with viruses. You try to, that's what you do with sickness, actually.
Right. But the difference is that those others were either dismissed or they're not talked about by the people that matter.
Yeah.
This one, because maybe it's coming from Pfizer, may matter.
I think that's probably right. And the day of the announcement, Moderna stock collapsed, you know. But for some reason, you know, all rationality has been lost here. You'd think that with a good therapeutic, and apparently this is one of them, that the enthusiasm of vaccine mandates and boosters and, you know, boosting every 5-year-old or whatever, you know, would diminish. But for some reason, all these things seem to be happening at once, and which makes you wonder, you know, what is the end game here? You know, is it all just about the bio passports and social credit, you know, eventually in surveillance, this biofascist surveillance state? I don't know. That's a lot of people say that. I don't know. All I know is that nothing's made sense to me for nearly 2 years now. And I spend all my time trying to make sense of it, but it's getting increasingly difficult.
And the FDA, they approved boosters for minors, but they didn't test boosters on minors. And we had a doctor on who said, you have a 1 in 1 million chance in that age group of dying from COVID, but 1 in 2,340 chance of getting myocarditis after
booster. Right.
So why?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a lot of studies on this, but your risk of adverse effects is higher than your risk from COVID. And I think this is well known, but I think saying that, you know, on Twitter now gets your account taken down. And I saw that Peter McCullough's interview with Joe Rogan, which was very interesting. I listened to maybe 30 minutes or 3 hours, but it, you know, that guy is so articulate and a real doctor who's, you know, really addressed COVID since the beginning. But his 3-hour-long interview with Rogan was taken down by YouTube, you know, just taken down.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's that might go to the question about whether this is sort of a techno-authoritarian state in the making in the West.
Well, and, you know, the other thing is, I don't know if you looked at YouTube's new terms of service, but, I mean, everything we're saying right now on the air would be banned. And YouTube is not just a video service. That's Google's company. And Google is the number one website in the world, hosting 90% of the web searches. YouTube is the second most important website in the world, hosting, you know, about 80% of all video. So it really matters when you have, you know, a ruling class outsourcing its censorship to these companies. And it really affects the public mind, what people think. And what I'm seeing here is quite dark. These companies imagining that they can just blot out the truth and control people through their terms of service. And the dissidents, you know, are always going to remain such a tiny minority that we're not going to make any real impact on the trajectory of public life. Or so they believe.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's true. I think we've got a real chance here, a fighting chance, for regaining our liberties and putting our civilization back together again. I believe that it can be done because of passion and the courage of people who have really, you know, decided that they're not going to sit by and watch their lives ruined and wrecked by the likes of the New York Times and Google and Big Pharma. And I'm seeing the, I'm sure you are too, the growth of a real, you know, sort of resistance, and at least people willing to step up and take risks and say no to this.
Well,
and that's what it's going to take.
Yeah, I mean, look, against the backdrop of the virus appearing to get weaker as it mutates with, like, Omicron, you have some of these more stringent policies being imposed, including, you know, camps in Australia and prison sentences in Austria. So it's going to take some real passion and some real organized dissidents, I think, to reverse this trend.
Yeah. You know, I know it's terrible in Australia and it's terrible all over the flipping world, but it's bad enough in New York.
Yeah, well, right.
You know? I mean, I know people are suffering all over the world, and this sounds like a petty problem, but I'm headed to New York tomorrow. I wonder, there's a really nice old family there. It's lived in a fancy house on the Upper East Side for decades. You know, like a Scion sort of level family. You know, wealthy, well-to-do, top league, you know, society elite in New York. They don't want the vaccination, so they're refusing it. Also, they're morally scrupulous enough to not fake it, unlike half the other people in New York, right? So, I don't know if you know that, but half.
Yeah.
So, I wanted to have a nice dinner with them tomorrow night because I'm speaking at the Metropolitan Club or something like that. You know, I'm not even allowed into any restaurant.
Right.
I mean, I'm going to have to get Chinese takeout and invite them to my hotel room.
You know? So ridiculous.
Are you sure you're going to be able to? Are you sure you'll get into the venue for your speech?
Oh, you asked about me in particular?
Yeah, yeah. Are you going to be able to get into the venue where you're speaking?
Yeah. Well, but.
You have some connections, right? But it's all like, you know, it's all very on the hush hush. I'm breaking into a place where I've been invited to speak.
Well, you know, and the fact that I can't just have a dinner, I can't go to New York. You know, I can't even go to dinner with my friends. The whole everything's become crazy, and we're putting up with this crap. you know, I don't know. Jordan Peterson said something about this. You know, they push a little further, push a little bit further, and push a little bit further. And you keep putting up with it. And after a while, you know, it really does become the new normal. I think a lot of people in New York are kind of waiting for the next mayor to say, oh, this is dumb. Let's go back to the way it was. I'm not sure that's going to happen, though. You know, I'm just not sure about that. I hope it does. It's outrageous how our lives become. And
yeah.
I'm glad about DeSantis. God bless that man in Florida, right? I mean, you know, every time he speaks, he's all about freedom and liberties and stuff. You know, that's nice. Unlike Biden. Biden was just yesterday making fun of the idea of freedom. He said, don't tell me about your freedom. Tell me about your patriotism.
Right.
That's what he said yesterday.
Right.
So I'm glad for Florida. But, you know, here's the thing. I'm thrilled for Florida. It's just great. But it's the whole civilization is sweeping towards the totalitarianism. You know, you'll be safer in Florida, but you're not going to be finally safe, you know? We all use the same dollar. That's being destroyed. We've got a White House now that's telling everybody that inflation is caused by greed, you know? That happened yesterday. So they don't have a clue. Productivity is collapsing. I was looking at the data on labor productivity this morning, which is a funny little figure, but it's just how much productivity traces each individual labor. And what you see is a real collapse, you know? I mean, it's looking dangerous. Investment is vanishing. It's decoupled from the stock market. So we've got serious economic troubles coming. And Floridians are not going to be spared this. So it's going to affect everybody. It's in everybody's interest, like right now, to do whatever you can to throw yourself into battle against what's happened to us over the last 2 years. Sorry for getting passionate.
No, that's good. That's good. End with a clarion call. Perfect. Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute, author of the book Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey, enjoy New York, and thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Fun with your takeout Chinese. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.